I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Lawmakers are putting the final touches on the state budget and preparing to head home when the session wraps up at the end of the week. We'll talk with 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry about the final days of the session, politicking around the Orlando-Orange County Expressway Authority, and what Obama political advisor David Axelrod said about former Governor Charlie Crist. In the second part of the program, we talk with local filmmaker Todd Thompson about his film, The Highwayman. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7's political commentators, Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, of course, former Democratic State House representative and now president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Good to have you.
But yet still a Democrat.
Still a Democrat. And Republican Lou Fry, former congressman from this area and now attorney with Lowndes, Drostek, Doster, Kanner, and Reed. Good to have you in, Lou.
Always good to be with you guys.
So this week, the legislative session coming to an end, it's been kind of a raucous ride. It seemed like budget hearings were stalled there for a while last week, and now it looks like they're moving forward. We already know lawmakers working over the weekend, committees holding meetings, so you know these guys are ramping up to get things done and get out of here. And bills are flying through now that redistricting and the budget are the final stages that they're trying to accomplish.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be out in the limb on that one so far.
Tell me why. Reapportionment?
Tell me why.
Well, you're in a process, and you could hear the hearings up there were pretty cantankerous in terms of the different viewpoints, and the question is going to be, what is the court going to do? Is the court going to throw it back to the state legislature? And if you do, what are they going to do? And they could just make a little change and throw it back again. I mean, this has the possibilities of going on for a few more months.
And it seemed like the court had some kind of pointed questions about those districts and how they were drawn.
Yeah. That Amendments 5 and 6, which we passed, and nobody really knew what we passed because 40% of the people in the state don't even know the three branches of government, are giving the courts a lot of fun on that. And, Dick, don't you think that it was they were drawn so much so that you knew you're going to end up in the courts?
Well, the bottom line is, you know, we've said this before, if the Democrats in charge, they draw the districts. Republicans, as a case now, they draw the districts. And they're politically drawn. We know that. However, as Lou mentioned, you had Amendments 5 and 6, which gave guidelines for the legislature to draw the districts. And the court has to look at that. The interesting thing is the House attorney for the House before the Supreme Court, basically argued that the court should set aside Amendment 5 and 6 and revisit it sometime later, which begs the question were the districts drawn to be very political. The bottom line is—
And the court looks like it might even just throw it back to the legislature.
And I think
that's probably going to happen.
Do it. Otherwise, then you've got the court in a position to try to do their own reapportionment map without the background, without the political nuances, without the knowledge. And I would say that there were an unprecedented number of public hearings, a lot of public input. They really did all those things. But by the same token, the districts
wouldn't you
are
say
what
attempted,
they are.
Attempted input? Because a lot of times it was just for show.
Well, they did. They had some attempted inputs, but they had some genuine input. But the fact is they are very guarded about Amendment 5 and 6. And Amendment 5 and 6 would be the issues of primacy with the court. And the court very well could go back to the legislature and say, do it over again. It could put them in a very extended session.
What do you think in terms of the end of session here? We're seeing a lot of bills starting to fly through. We just saw, for instance, Senator Gary Siplin's measure. He's a Democrat here in Orlando, passing a measure to allow students to initiate school prayer, and that looks like it's going to be signed by Governor Scott. What do you think about that, Dick Batchelor?
Well, the bill is one of those bills of feel-good kind of pieces of legislation that they're loading up with it. They had the abortion issue again, and a lot of these other issues that need to be attended to really haven't been. It looks like, though, they will get some personal injury protection legislation done. They will not get prison privatization done. They will get the budget done, and they'll try to get it on time, which is, by the way, the only thing that the Constitution requires the legislature to do is to balance the budget and go home.
And they which would is like, not a bad idea.
Which is not a bad idea, but the reapportionment order to keep them there. Yeah. So a lot of the major legislation they haven't attended to yet. And there's still about 2,000 bills that are pending in the process. The good news is they won't get to most of those.
Yeah.
And, of course, the governor's trying to – he's got his program. He wants to get reelected. He worked a lot better with the legislature this time than before. But, for instance, his corporate tax reduction, and I think we're lower 5.5 compared to the national 6.5%, and he's trying to lower that more and use that as a real stalking horse to say, hey, we're getting a lot more jobs this way. Personally, I think we'd do a lot better if we tied some education money into the actual job market and train our young people for jobs that are out there rather than non-existent jobs. But anyway, he's trying, I guess, and you got to give him credit for that.
You bring up education. It's interesting right now. New rules passed by the State Board of Education would change the way schools are graded. We heard our own superintendent, Ron Blocker, who is also the head of the State Association of School Superintendents, speaking about this bill. And it looks like it could trigger a lot of schools to get down into that D range again after we just saw schools kind of improving what traction they had had. What do you think about that, Dick Benchler?
Well, and it's difficult, too, because you're going to find great schools that were probably even A schools, at least B schools, and now be D schools. And it's so confusing to the public. And if you really want to complicate things, add No Child Left Behind on top of that and their rigorous testing, too. So I think it's going to be difficult. And the problem is when you grade a whole school, you know, based on what they call annual yearly progress, it's very, very difficult. And but what does it do in the end? The fact is the legislature, again, has failed to put the education funding in K through 12 that they cut out last year by $520 per student. And they've failed to fund public education. So at the same time, they're failing to fund public education where they're saying, you know, that these are our future. This is the most important thing. They're not funding education, but by the same token, imposing more rigorous standards.
Yeah, and the other thing that bothers me, we're talking about all these grades and that, and you know we still have something like 63.7% of the kids who finish high school.
Yeah,
I mean, we got a real problem out here, and changing the letter grade from one thing to the other with all the focus and time on it isn't going to make a difference. I wish we'd take the same energy and that and drive it into figuring out how to keep kids in school, because once they drop out, they're in an economic abyss. I mean, they're never going to have – not never, but it's very tough for them ever to make it out of that hole.
Is it also interesting that that's kind of an externality? Parents and teachers and lawmakers are looking at those school grades, but students in the schools, I can't imagine, are thinking about that very much. And how does that affect them
on the contrary, FCAT is very, very much at a preoccupation of mind, the students.
The FCAT is, but are they thinking about the grade of their school overall?
Not until they get a bad grade, and then it kind of stereotypes them. So you go to a D school, you no longer go to a B school. But I want to go back to education for a moment, because the legislature is not funding community colleges either. This is a great opportunity for people to go back and retrain, particularly if they're unemployed now and they need new skills to get back into the labor force.
And couldn't we also be seeing tuition rates go up at community colleges?
And again, to be fair, Florida has some of the lowest tuition in the country, but by the same token, the way they're rapidly escalating it from 15 to 30% a year and 45% over 2 years is going to price some people out of the market. And then you've got prepaid tuition, which is taking a lot more than anticipated in the bright future. So the fact is higher education in K through 12 and community college are not being adequately funded because of the budget constraints, but we keep imposing additional requirements on the system without additional revenues.
Money's supposed to be going into education, but we're also seeing cuts being made into medical facilities, hospitals, state children's hospitals facing cuts of tens of millions of dollars. And I wonder, have you guys given any thought, or do you hear, how would this affect Nemours that's being built right out at our own Lake Nona? Is that going to affect that hospital?
If I might interject real quickly, Lou, and then defer to you, that Nemours, no, because it's foundation funded. It's a not-for-profit hospital funded by a private Nemours foundation. But it will affect the other two hospitals because they're capping Medicaid. They're reducing Medicaid reimbursement rates to hospitals by 7%. And now the real debate is whether or not they're going to accept the federal dollars under the Affordable Health Care Act to basically reimburse general practitioners. So there really is a debate going on as to where the money is going to come from. But right now, they will cut Medicaid reimbursement to hospitals and some physicians, but Nemours would not be affected.
We're talking with 90.7's political commentators, Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Frey. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. I'm Mark Simpson. Let's talk a little bit about politics. You know, there still is talk.
Please.
Yes,
no, please.
I know you love it, Dick Batchelor. Don't kid me. Florida Governor Jeb Bush is being talked about more and more, not only as we see changes going on in Florida's education, but also still his name floating around as a potential presidential candidate, wondering should another Republican get into the big presidential race, or wondering about Mitt Romney's performance. Any chance of this happening at this late
There's
date?
Always a chance of it happening because there's only like 15% of the delegates been elected. And even after Super Tuesday, there'll be 60% of the delegates left. So theoretically, it's possible. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think what you're going to see in Super Tuesday is Romney will probably do good. And to try and match Romney and keep up, you have to raise money. And there's one thing about it, unless you're with most people, if the horse isn't running too well and is starting to breathe hard, it's very difficult to get the money. And I think that's what's going to happen. Neither Ron Paul's going to run, and he's going to stand no matter what. But Santorum doesn't have the organization, the feet on the ground in a lot of these states.
What do you think about Santorum's shift into social issues and Romney still trying to keep on economics?
I think Santorum is doing exactly what the Democrats want. You can't win with just the right. You got to win with the right in the middle, or as a Democrat, the left in the middle. And Santorum has got himself positioned so far over to the right that you can't see him. You got to get spy glasses. And that isn't going to be the way that you're going to win this campaign. And frankly, with a lot of these issues, it doesn't make any difference in abortion. Some of the people are with you, and some of the people are against you. And no matter what you say, it ain't going to make a difference. So just tell the truth. Tell people what you believe and move on to the next issue. But Santorum is spending his whole time, money, and that in that. And, you know, you say to yourself, is he running for vice president? Is he trying to stake out a position for vice president where Romney needs somebody to satisfy the right, the Tea Party and all that? Would it fit in that?
Would it also help Romney on the religion issue if Santorum was a running mate?
Don't know. Really don't know, but it might have a tendency to help. But there's other people like the governor of New Jersey, like the former senator from or the senator from Ohio and that. So there's a lot of other people out there. But, you know, I think he's running out of gas.
Santorum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Santorum has gotten so far to the right. He's really running for theologian in chief instead of commander in chief. So I don't know what he's doing. I don't think he's a good candidate for the ticket. I think Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio would be, but not Santorum.
I've written for a while about Bush and tried to get a little boomlet going way back in the past because I thought he really would have a shot to do it, and I think he's very talented. But I don't think he really wants to do it. I don't think he is going to do it, and I don't think he's going to get in the race.
What do you think is going to happen after Super Tuesday, Lou Frey?
What I think is going to happen is Santorum is going to look very hard at whether it's staying in or not. You know, you can stay in a race and raise some money, but you don't want to be embarrassed. You don't want to go out and come in second in two out of every three races and not really go anywhere. And the thrill is gone. Unless he gets an incredible bounce out of this Super Tuesday, I think Santorum is going to seriously consider dropping out of the race and coming back into the fold. And by the way, speaking of the fold, the biggest problem the Republicans have is keeping Ron Paul as a Republican and not running as an independent. If he runs as an independent, Obama's the president.
You've already got one independent in the race, most likely is Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico. And he could be in the race now, but he hasn't gotten a lot of traction yet, a lot of attention. He could in the general election. But I think Santorum basically doesn't survive for very long after Super Tuesday. I think he gets a book contract and a job offer from Fox TV.
Dick Batchelor, let me ask you about these comments from David Axelrod, advisor to President Obama, about Charlie Crist. David Axelrod writing recently, the president has very high regard for Governor Crist. He made a really courageous decision back in 2009, and there's no doubt he made it because he thought it was what was best for the state of Florida. He understood the politics were difficult, and he made it nonetheless. He deserves enormous credit for that and the courage he showed. You know, we all talk about what we want public officials to do and who are willing to put that next generation ahead of the next election. He was willing to make a decision like that, so we admire him.
And what was that decision?
Which
one of the many was he talking about?
I think it's a great invitation to switch parties.
I think we're talking about that move Crist made to independent candidate status. So what do you think? If David Axelrod is saying positive things like that, are we going to see Democrat Charlie Crist roll out?
He's going to run in Chicago.
It might be. I think, and with nice comments, and certainly it certainly doesn't bode well for Charlie if he ever wanted to run as a Republican again, which I don't think he would be. I still don't understand why he would want to run. The fact is he's making more money than he's ever made with Morgan & Morgan, and he's probably enjoying life a great deal. But that doesn't matter. I mean, he might decide to run. His wife has wealth, too. But if he runs, I think right now he could never run as a Republican again.
He'd have to get a Democrat. I wouldn't be surprised if he run for the Congress in a Democratic district, pick one out in a period of time. And if he can get some help from the White House to muscle some people out of it, you know, Charlie's been running his whole life. I don't think he's going to stop.
Nope.
I wonder if you guys have been following this fight over the Orange County Expressway Authority. There's moves afoot in Tallahassee right now by local representative Mike Horner, and also we hear Dean Cannon weighing in to try to isolate Teresa Jacobs, if not remove her outright from the board of the Orange County Expressway Authority. I wonder, what is your take on those maneuverings? Because Jacobs is known for trying to bring more transparency and kind of clean up that agency.
I agree with Teresa. I think it was intentional. I think because she tried to clean up the agency, because she, you know, pushed back people like Jim Palmer, who's could make, you know, with Expressway goes by his property, the Beltway, he's a developer. He could do $1 billion a project. The speaker designate, Chris Dorworth, is on his payroll, and he was also supported the new executive director of the Expressway Authority. I think it's all politics. I mean, why? It begs the question. Teresa Jacobs is known for a lot of things, one of which, transparency, ethics in government, and no conflicts of interest. So to me, it's very, very fishy.
There's another thing, too, is that, frankly, the government that's closest to the people usually the best. And if the control's in Tallahassee, I don't think you're going to get the overview that you would need if it was right here, right in front of us, where we could look in every day and see what's going on.
So do you think Jacobs is going to be able to fight against this, or are the cards stacked against her?
Well, the further irony of this thing, she's the strongest Republican in Orange County right now. And so why would you take her on? And I would imagine she's already burned up the phone to the governor and say, Governor, I mean, you know, you supported me on this, you supported me on other things, and, you know, you need to weigh in on this whole thing and basically say if it comes out, you'll veto it, at least exert some kind of behind the scenes.
And that'll be a real test of the governor's leadership, of what he's going to do, how far he's willing to go out, and is he counting votes well?
That's former Republican Congressman Lou Frey, now attorney with Lowndes, Drostek, Doster, Kanner, and Reed. Lou, thanks for sharing the story.
And thank this firm, too, for allowing me to bring him to the table.
Also, we were joined by our regular Democratic political commentator. That's former State Representative Democrat Dick Batchelor, the president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group.
I have always wanted to be president of something.
I'd vote for you.
Thank you.
I'd run as an independent as your vice president.
Next on Intersection, filmmaker Todd Thompson discusses his new project about the roadside Florida artists known as the Highwaymen.
We live in a world where black is black and white is white. Who would have thought all the colors in between would change our lives forever? In time, they will call us artists. But to most, we was known as the Highwaymen.
That's the trailer from the film The Highwaymen. It's about a group of young black artists in Central Florida. They came out onto those highways in the 1950s and 60s and started selling paintings of the tropical landscape around them as a way to make a living. They became known as the Highwaymen. Today, their paintings are among the most prized by collectors and valued at hundreds of thousands of dollars. Todd Thompson is a Central Florida filmmaker who spent two decades researching the Highwaymen. He's working on a feature-length film about these artists with his production company, Stars North. Todd, good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how did you become interested in the Highwaymen?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I moved to Florida from – I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I relocated down here right after college to work at Disney. And, you know, I've been involved in movies since I was eight. And after moving and getting settled here in Florida, started volunteering at the Florida Film Festival and you know, getting back involved in working in films as an actor and whatnot. And just through a mutual friend at Disney who happened to be a Highwayman collector, learned about who these artists were. And it's one of these stories that just always sort of resonated with me and stayed in the back of my mind as something that I knew I would like to tell one day as a director, as a writer and producer. So it's literally what happened. I stuck it in my back pocket, and over the course of the next 10 years, making other films, working with other people, I formed a partnership with a co-producer of mine named Catherine Kelly. She, on her own, actually had a passion for the Highwaymen. She had discovered the Highwaymen through Gary Monroe's book, which came out, you know, about 10 years ago. And she, I believe, she had seen Gary at a book signing down in Tampa. So she had met with him separately. You know, took a meeting with him way back in the day, and just said, you know, this is something I'm interested in as well. And then she and I met, had this common love for the Highwaymen story, and the rest is sort of history.
What do you like about the story, and what do you like about the artwork?
Well, I mean, the artwork's beautiful. I mean, if you love landscape painting, I mean, it's a great way to preserve old Florida, if you will. I mean, I think that's what resonated with the people who bought the paintings back in the day. You know, a lot of tourists bought them. They'd come down and spend time in the state and, you know, buy one of these paintings for $20-$30 on the road and take it back north with them. And I always remember the sunshine, you know, those cold wintry days, I guess. So, but, you know, historically, it's just kind of a neat way to preserve what Florida used to look like. I mean, there's still patches of landscape that still looks like that, but, you know, the state's so developed or getting so developed, it's hard to find that now. So it's a nice way to preserve that, almost like a picture.
And give us a sense of what you're trying to capture in the film itself, the era that it took place. That's 1950s and 60s Deep South. You got Jim Crow. You've got racial segregation, those sort of things. What are you trying to evoke in the film?
Well, I mean, one thing I'm not trying to evoke is this isn't going to be a film about victims. I mean, these are black artists. They certainly grew up in a time when, you know, blacks and whites couldn't sit in the same restaurant, couldn't use the same bathroom, couldn't drink from the same water fountain. That's definitely going to be in the background of when our story takes place. But this is truly, truly, truly a story about people who were entrepreneurs, and they were looking for a way. They were looking for a purpose of who they were and what their life was all about. And they wanted to make opportunity for themselves. So, I mean, what resonates with me with the story is, you know, especially during these tough economic times, is it's hard enough to be an entrepreneur as it is, let alone try to be an entrepreneur and not be able to take a meeting because I can't walk into the building because I'm black or whatnot. So these guys really persevered, and they never gave up, and they never took no for an answer. And that's what the story is about for me.
Who are the central characters?
There's basically three central characters. There's Alfred Hare's our hero. He was the kid in high school who had a talent for painting and a little flair for making money. He wanted to be a millionaire by the time he was 30. He was introduced to a white artist named Bean Backus, who was basically the Norman Rockwell of landscape painters back in the day. And he was just, you know, world renowned, very well respected, very well paid as an artist. And Bean, interesting story with him was he was in his 40s. He had just gotten married late in life, and 5 years into the marriage, his wife died from a congenital heart condition. And he had actually suggested and forced her to go get the surgery, and she died from it. So he was in a huge state of guilt. He went to Jamaica to drink himself to death, and something brought him back to Fort Pierce where he lived. And it was then that he met Alfred, and he basically took Alfred under his wing and mentored him. And so for as much as Bean gave Alfred the opportunity to become a painter, Alfred sort of saved his life as well. So that's nice. That's really where the story's going. And it was interesting. So we've got those two characters, Alfred and Bean, and then Harold Newton, who a lot of people consider to be the first Highwayman artist. He was another black man in town who was a painter and basically painted out of necessity whenever he needed to, and he would sell door to door. So Alfred took Bean's artistic genius, if you will, and Harold's innovative ways of making money and put it in hyperdrive and, you know, took his knowledge back to Blacktown where they lived, taught some of his friends how to paint. They all painted together in these big backyard paint parties and basically overnight would paint 20, 30, 40 paintings a night and go on the road the next day and sell them. So whatever he couldn't make up for in price, he made up for in volume, which is how he made his money.
A real kind of production line almost.
Yeah, almost. I mean, I don't want to say it was assembly line because that's really not the right way to say it, but it was they worked in volume. I mean, Alfred sat down and said, I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. This is how many paintings I got to do. And every day he knocked them out, and he built a sales team, and they hit the road and sold them.
I'm talking with Todd Thompson, Central Florida filmmaker. He's working on a film about the Highwaymen, that famous group of black Florida artists in the 1950s and 60s. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM, Orlando. What about a direct firsthand research on this? Are you able to talk to any Highwaymen today to get insight?
Oh, yeah. That's probably been the best part. You know, like I said, we've been, you know, I've been wanting to do this story for about 10 years. But last year, I turned 40 and, you know, my birthday, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this story this year. This is the year we're going to do this. So I spent all of last year going back and forth to Fort Pierce, meeting with the artists, the surviving family members, if you will, people who are affiliated with the story. We interviewed them. We've got, like you said, 20 years of research built up just over the course of this last year that's up on a wall in our studio, just that's turning its way into a script, you know, making its way into the story. So it was a fun, interesting journey just getting to know them over the years and talking to them and, you know, becoming friends with them.
How hard is it to go back and try to recapture that era in Florida today when we've seen so much development all around the state? Can you still find it somewhere?
Yeah, we are going to find it. It's great. I mean, there's still little nuggets of, you know, there's still little places around town that you could still see a little 1950s, 60s architecture, you know, peeking through. And, you know, a lot of it's going to be really clever production design and whatnot. But the story took place here and we intend to film it here, really, quite honestly.
How far are you going to take this story? Because those paintings have really gone a long way. They're in art museums around the state. They were in the Capitol, in the governor's mansion. I mean, it's kind of a sign of pride to have a Highwayman painting nowadays.
It really is. And that's what I think really attracts us to the story. You know, you got these guys who really quite honestly struggled most of their lives just making a living, becoming artists. And there were galleries back then that wouldn't see them because they were black. There were museums that wouldn't talk to them. You know, people would basically slam the door in their face. And now, to your point, you know, their paintings are hanging in the governor's mansion, in the Capitol building, at the White House. You know, James Gibson is very good friends with the Bush family just over the years, getting to know each other. And it just shows, it's kind of a, for me, it's inspirational because it shows, you know, if you really truly believe in who you are and what you're all about, don't give up because good things lie ahead.
Talk to me a little bit about the project side of things. This project is underway, but it hasn't been fully green-lighted, fully funded. Where are you in that process?
We're in the process of developing the film right now. So what that means basically is we're working on the script fast and feverishly. We are also raising funds for the project. The film's going to be shot as a SAG ultra-low budget film, which according to the Screen Actors Guild guidelines, we really can't spend a penny over $200,000 to make the film. So we're raising enough money to shoot the film and market and distribute. We're in the midst of it right now. I mean, we've got a funding site right now on Kickstarter. There's it's a crowdfunding platform where people can come and make a pledge. It's not really a donation. You're going and you're pledging to the project because you believe in it. And in return for your pledge, you're getting a free DVD. You're getting a T-shirt. You get a chance to maybe appear in the film. I mean, whatever pledge level you decide to come in at. So it's kind of a fun little experience there, raising funds. And then we're also, you know, meeting with, you know, private individuals who have an affinity and a tie to the story, who are really passionate about seeing it being made.
Any big names you're trying to cast?
Yes, of course. Nothing I can really say right now, but it's definitely one of those stories that I really truly feel in my heart that the right actors will come along, and I'm really anxious to see who we end up putting together for the cast.
Todd Thompson, I can't wait to see it. He's a Central Florida filmmaker with Stars North, working on a film about the Highwaymen. Nice to speak with you, Todd.
Very nice speaking with you.
You can find out more about the Highwaymen film and catch our weekly podcast online at WMFE.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.